Welcome back to MERS Monday for more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, the team is joined by legislative strategist Sarah Hubbard of Acuitas LLC and Jim Murray, a senior government relations professional at Tradecraft Strategies. Together, they discuss how energy policy could take the front seat for fall 2023 and what legislation might be saved for next year. Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson explains how legal scholars are now considering whether past President Donald Trump's indictments disqualify him from state presidential primary ballots in 2024. Now, here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber and editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. If I had to describe today's episode, and I'm going to modestly knock on some wood before I say this, it would be ultimately the calm before the storm. Labor Day weekend is approaching, but before we send off summer 2023, the governor is giving a what's next address on Wednesday, where she's poised to ask legislators to approve further reproductive health care reforms, paid family leave, policy measures to lower prescription drug prices, and bills to enshrine clean energy and fossil fuel reduction goals into state law. Today, we are joined by legislative strategist Sarah Hubbard of Acuitas LLC and Birmingham-based Jim Murray, a senior government relations professional at Tradecraft Strategies. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Now, when we think both about the desire to conclude the year with wide-reaching reforms and about the ticking clock as talk continues about the legislature adjourning early this year, are these what next ambitions realistic? What do you think, Sarah?
Well, I think they're realistic around the things the legislature has been preparing for over the summer and some of these things that just haven't quite been finished. So as you mentioned, we know the governor is going to be talking about energy policy. There are a variety of policies she's already leaked into the media that are things that the legislature has been talking about. They're embodied in legislation that was introduced in the spring. So we think that those are probably goals that can be accomplished. But the legislature has many, many goals in the area of energy, and it's not clear that everything the legislature wants to do will be included. So the governor's talking about what we've seen so far, a clean energy standard, more with energy efficiency, more responsibility for the Public Service Commission, and tackling the issues of siting solar energy in particular, let alone renewables. And I think that siting bill is going to be the one that's super hard. That's the one where the legislature is going to have a strong opinion, but so are local units of government and their representatives. You know, there are a lot of legislators that are very sensitive to the needs of local control and local government. And I think that's going to be a toughie.
You know, energy, abortion, paid leave, you know, all of these seem to be very hot topics. Jim, my question for you, which of these topics that we're anticipating to define the end of 2023, which one do you think is most likely to boost up the governor's national audience?
Well, I doubt that that's her goal, but I would say that energy is going to be the big focus for this fall.
And why is that, Jim? Is it setting like we're gonna get 100% renewables? And I mean, that is a bold goal.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've seen, I have been, Kyle, I know you've been here 20 some years. I've been here 30 some years. Sarah's been here 30 some years. That how much this legislature has actually completed in the first 9 months of this year. I mean, they've had 40 years of pent up issues. And one of the last, I think, on the list of the big issues is the environmental community. And I think that's why it's going to get such a big focus in the governor's speech and why I think it will be a main push of the legislature this fall.
Sarah mentioned the whole siting argument, and we're probably talking about siting windmills maybe, or definitely solar farms for sure. What would you agree with her that that's the biggest struggle she's going to have on the energy front, or is it the push to 100% renewables at a time when DTE has already put in a brand new natural gas plant over by Port Huron?
Well, I think that they're related. I mean, I think that they are two heads of the same issue. You know, you want to get to 100% renewable. How are you going to do that? You're going to need to have solar fields. And so I think there's probably a grand bargain out there somewhere.
You know, Jim, Sarah, either of you could respond to this. I think one thing that's interesting about the utilities legislation is that the environmentalist community, they've created this report that say, you know, when it comes to legislation like a 100% clean energy standard by 2035 enshrined into state law, you know, these proposals could potentially attract $7.8 billion in extra federal investment to Michigan. And, you know, I think overall what makes this unique is that, you know, obviously, our budgets aren't going to look the same as they have in the last 2 years. And this could be Democrats' real case to say that, you know, they're fighting for further federal dollars.
Yeah, that's a real thing. Absolutely. There is a lot of money on the table. The Biden administration is doing everything they can to provide incentives and subsidies for this transition to clean energy. You know, one policy I'll call out that's related to a lot of that federal funding is known as community solar. And that's one that if it's a policy that's changed and included in this package that goes through, could also unlock a lot of federal funding, tens of millions of dollars all alone for that kind of a policy change. But we think it could require some changes in statute to get there. So it's a good example of something where the legislature needs to really move on these items in many cases to unlock that federal funding.
Passage of community solar in statute is essential to get the hands on all of the community solar funding that's on the table from the Inflation Reduction Act. And it's got to be done in statute. All the easy ways have been done. And now it's got to get passed by the legislature this fall. And there's a clock ticking too. So it has to happen before the first of the year.
Speaking of siting because what we're talking about here, and I can see the problem that the Democrats are going to have here, because it's very much the same kind of argument, I think, as aggregates, and that the whole thing about aggregates is that we want to set the statewide policy so that the locals can't put the squeeze and say, no, you can't dig your mine here. But then you're going to go ahead and say, we're going to create a statewide policy as it relates to the siting of a solar field. But that's okay. Is there a philosophical disconnect here?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, we've got lofty renewable goals. And in order to get there, you're going to have to build the renewables. And, you know, community solar in particular are smaller. They're about 30 acres in size. So, you know, they tend to be a little easier to site. I think the state and the utilities have discovered that to do utility scale size solar, they're much, much larger. They're in the thousands of acres. It's harder to go into a township and say, we need this 10,000 acre site to do solar. So I think that's, if you're going to get to the corporate goals that the corporations in the state have, the state goals, the PSC goals, and the utility goals of getting to clean energy, you have to have a combination where you're able to cite the big ones and little ones.
Jim, is there a concern though, if we go too hard, too fast on the renewables, that it's gonna create a rate increase, especially if DTE is sitting on a natural gas plant that's brand new they can't use?
Well, you know, the PSC will control the program. I mean, that's why we have an independent agency doing that. And in the case of community solar, they will set the bill credit. And, you know, unless they set it at an incredibly high number, you know, we're not going to have that kind of cost shift problem. And currently right now, both of the major utilities in the state have a solar program. But if you want to participate in it, they charge you more. So, you know, we kind of already have that situation going on right now in the state.
You know, I think my next big question here is what gets left behind? You know, obviously the clock is ticking right now. The governor is about to outline her priorities. Individual legislators have their own priorities. What do you think is going to get left behind?
I've been doing some thinking on that question. I think it's a great question. And I think it's not just what gets left behind, but it's what gets saved for next year as well. So next year being an election year for the House, you know, when the Republicans were in control, you could always count on an election year, including three different things: income taxes, abortion, and guns. That's what they always wanted to do. You could go back and look at historically every time I think they had some kind of vote relative to an election year. Democrats might have a slightly different approach, although I'd say abortion and guns could still be near the top of their list for 2024 issues. And then maybe voting rights is another very popular one with the Democratic leadership that could be perhaps held until next year, is how I would assert. And I think some of the abortion items still on the table related to parental notification and such are pretty complicated. Are those things poised to go in the next couple of months? I'm not sure, but I could see some of those being, you know, left until next year. But one of the big ones that we've heard Mayor Duggan talk about a lot is this land value tax. And that's one that has a lot of moving pieces. You know, he proposed it at the Detroit Regional Chamber Mackinac Policy Conference this spring. We still haven't seen legislation introduced. We've heard about some work going on behind the scenes on that. But as I understand it, this proposal is a, you know, once in the country, sort of, you know, would be the first in the country to actually be enacted if we did it in this regard. And it's something that a lot of people have been thinking about for a long time, but not doing. And to me, that sounds complicated. It might be a good idea, but I think it's something that will likely require some debate. So if that one doesn't make it through in the next couple of months, I would not be shocked.
That's something the House really wants to get done, isn't it? I thought Speaker Tate has an interest in that.
I think he does. Yep. And I think he's, you know, as a representative of Detroit, I think he really wants to do that for the mayor. I'm just saying, you know, from a policy standpoint and all the moving parts and the complications of a major change in tax law like that. And then, you know, I think this also require approval by the citizens of Detroit. So there's a lot of pieces to it that need to be sorted out, and it just gets complicated. You know, maybe a good idea that we'll get through quickly. We'll see. I mean, I think there's a lot of support for it. It's just a matter of the details of how it works.
I think in every year I've ever worked in the legislature, the enemy is time, you know, just not enough time to do all the things you want to do just because of the nature of the legislature. But as I said in the beginning, like, I don't rule this legislature out. They have accomplished a lot in a short period of time, and they may be saving some things to do next year that are, you know, voter friendly, like the transparency and the FOIA stuff and, you know, more voting rights stuff. So that's what I think how that will play out at the end of this year.
You know, what about some of the labor legislation that's already started to receive hearings? Specifically, I'm thinking about the legislation to allow local municipalities to set their own regulations for wages and benefits for companies that operate in their jurisdictions. Is that something that we're going to see? It's still a lot of enthusiasm toward among Democrats, or is that something gets left behind because of, you know, low appetite?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one that you're going to see more opposition to from various stakeholders. So the Democratic majority has been very adept at, you know, feeding their stakeholders, right? Feeding all the people who have a lot of needs. The largest one that is missing still is the environmental community, but I think their turn's coming with this clean energy legislation. But labor in general has received a lot of attention this year, early in the year. And so, and most of those issues that they received attention on haven't had real specific and organized opposition. It's been a bit spotty. You know, some of these things have been issues where I think opponents have been like, well, okay, we know they're going to get this through. So not a lot of strong opposition. I think we're starting to get into a level of policy, though, related to labor, where you're going to see a lot more opposition in something that they just haven't encountered yet. And it's going to be much harder for them to maintain those majorities when doing things like local, you know, starting to tinker with local control, starting to really get into the business community's agenda. It's just not going to be as easy as what we saw earlier this year.
The next question I want to ask is about this conversation we've had the last few podcasts about sign and die and adjourning early in order to get that presidential primary into law and activated by February 27. I want to ask both of you, Sarah, first of all, as a multi-client, are you already presuming that the legislature will adjourn in late October, early November?
Well, we're certainly encouraging all our clients who have a policy item on the agenda to move as quickly as possible. That given that possibility, we don't want to plan on needing those December session days for anything, certainly. So I think that rumor is real. I don't understand why they would make a decision on that before the November election for those two seats that are up with House members. So I don't ex- you know, personally don't expect to see that decision made before the November election.
And then, Jim, as somebody who used to work for a speaker, I know that you've been strategizing or thinking about this in your head. Does it make sense from a strategy standpoint to adjourn early if the goal is to get that early primary? Or do you just say, you know what, we really don't need this early primary. Forget it. We'll just do March 11 and be done with it.
Well, I think there's a few factors in there. I mean, I think when I was in the speaker's office, we had a Democratic governor and we were a Republican speaker. So, I mean, that wasn't even going to be on the table. We were going to sine die on like the 30th of December, no matter what. But I think the speaker and the Senate Majority Leader and the governor have been working hand in hand very well this year. They know the importance to the National Democratic Party to have that primary in February. And I think they probably still have a few procedural items that they could go through and to try to do that. But if they can't, I think they do adjourn. And then they have a special session with bills that are agreed upon between the trifecta.
You said that there could be some procedural things they could do. What
could pass, the bill again through both chambers and give it immediate effect, or whatever. I mean, just do whatever that they could try to do to make that not happen. And maybe there's something that we don't know about that the Republicans want where they could get 6 or 7 votes for immediate effect, or I don't know. I'm just sure that there's a lot of tools that aren't public that have been played yet, but I think if they don't get them, I do think that they go early.
I think relative to that too, there's always the lever of a supplemental budget. And we have heard rumors that a supplemental budget is teed up for between now and the end of the year at some point. And, usually there's a book closing in there, there's lapsed funds, there's more GF than they realize they have, that kind of thing. How could that play into this whole discussion as well is a big question in my mind.
And then Sarah's right, with the elections in November, if the House goes 54-54, I think it would be, if you sine die early, you take 2 months of headaches for the House and the Senate off the table immediately before the special elections can happen in early next year.
I mean, the governor could still call special session for December too, just depending on what that looks like with that in the House, right? I mean, I don't know. They'll have a lot of calculations to make at that point, but maybe a budget is the kind of thing, a supplemental budget that works in a special session because there's lots of items for everybody.
I'm going to ask both of you this, but why do you think the governor needs to host this address? Is it because is this kind of an early indication that there could be a special session hosted and this is what will be on the letter when she calls the legislature back? Is it because, her and the Democrats aren't completely united and everyone has their own unique goals of what they want for the end of the year? What is the overall point of this?
I think it's just a good idea to, people have been gone for 2 months. She's coming back and trying to refocus the agenda. I think it's a really, really good idea as a way to go into the busy fall session and kind of just do a reset.
We saw Rick Snyder when he was governor do policy addresses on a fairly regular basis as well. And that's how he set up a lot of his major initiatives. I don't know that this governor is doing it quite the same way, but certainly there's some precedent for this kind of thing outside of just a state of the state. The other thing is you asked earlier about her national profile. I may differ from Jim a little bit on that. I think she is very interested in keeping her national profile very high. This gives an opportunity to get some more coverage out there related to her bold agenda, as we expect to come this week, and keep her position for whatever might happen. You hear lots of rumors out there amongst Democrats and Republicans about who likely nominees are for president. While, President Biden is running for reelection, you never know what's going to happen. And I think Governor Whitmer is very savvy in her ability and interest to position herself for any outcome that might happen between now and next year's elections.
And plus, she made a commitment to the DNC to have the primary moved up, and then, it would be a little bit embarrassing if they didn't do it. So I think that's on everybody's mind.
All right. So this special message, this what's next address, isn't going to be done at the Capitol. It's not going to be done in the House chambers. It'll be at a different venue outside of the Capitol building itself. So there is no requirement that anyone necessarily has to be there. But obviously, legislators from both parties are expected to be there. So here's my last question for me. Jim, how many House and Senate Republicans will show up at the What's Next address?
Zero.
Ooh, Sarah, how many do you think will show up?
Oh, I think there could be a couple. There could be those that are going to get a, you know, shout out from various policies, potentially. There could be a couple that are interested and willing. We've seen a number of Republicans cross over and vote in support of things with the Democratic majority on everything from LGBTQ related legislation to the budgets to wide variety of things. So the Dem majority has proven they can be bipartisan when, you know, they really need to be. And it would send a nice signal to the Lansing crowd, let alone to the general public, if we had some bipartisanship in this address.
All right. So if we got 54 Republican House members, 18 Republican senators, that's 72. Out of 72, I'm going to put a number. I'm going to say seven. I'm going to go seven will be there. I don't know who the seven are, but I'm just going to spitball that number. I bet you they will not be mathematics, though.
Well, I mean, if it wasn't the Wednesday before Labor Day, I might add a couple on there. But, you know, that factors in there, too. You know?
Very true, Jim.
I know that we talked a bit about energy policy, it kind of being a huge theme. And honestly, kind of looking at the last few episodes with MERS Monday, I feel like this almost seems like a bit of a utilities podcast as well. What else do you think could get catapulted over the finish line? You know, they come back after Labor Day. What are kind of the next big things that they want to go at?
Well, I think you're going to find out Wednesday when the governor speaks. I mean, I have been pretty immersed in the energy category here for this whole year. So I don't know, to be honest.
We've heard some talk of, this has been public and reported on, of an interest in further regulation of flavored tobacco or flavored nicotine. That's something that seems a little below the radar, but, you know, I also would expect there to be significant pushback on efforts around that. We might see something around that this fall. And, you know, there's lots of cats and dogs legislation as well. Always that.
I want to ask, what happened to the train legislation? I'm not sure if you all have like observed that as much, but kind of after, you know, the East Palestine train incident, there was a huge discussion about how to make train operations safer in Michigan. Legislation was introduced, you know, requiring locomotive engine crews to have at least two members, and also mandating that freight and work trains traveling in Michigan be no longer than 7,500 feet. But, you know, is that something that, you know, there really hasn't been too much progress on, at least when it comes to the public committee hearing? Something could be going on privately, but is that something that could get left behind because no one's really talking about trains as much?
My experience working on policy related to railroads is it's very, very hard to impact the operations of railroads. They have such a high bar for federal protection and their federal regulations. So I'm not involved in this debate in Michigan right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if the advocates found out that there are some big ideas that of things they wanted to do that just aren't possible.
And, you know, legislative stuff just takes time. It just does. I know you used the words left behind, but we do still have a full legislative year next year. So they still have some time to work on it.
Looking at what is going to come next following Labor Day weekend, it could be legislative related, it could be anything political. What do you think is going to be some of the huge themes that you're zoomed in on for fall 2023?
Well, I'm going to be zoomed in on Michigan football. I'll tell you that. That's going to be a big one.
I bet you are.
So really looking forward to that. I hope the hype is accurate and that we live up to those expectations in Ann Arbor. But back to the legislature, boy, I just think we're going to be busy. And the other thing right now is just the unknown. What kinds of things are going to just percolate up? You know, we've seen this, there's a proposal about regulating animals out there, right? There's proposals about, you know, this is when all sorts of constitutional amendment type proposals spring forth from the shadows. It's often the unknown unknown that, you know, that gets us and keeps us the busiest.
No, there's some education stuff that's still out there. Senator Geis has a bill that would allow Michigan to have a national test for teacher testing certification rather than Michigan having their own Michigan specific. And that would allow Michigan to go out and recruit teachers in other states and to come here and teach. So that bill is still out there. So there's a lot of cats and dogs out there. Yeah, very busy.
Along those lines, we're working on licensure of dietitian nutritionists. That bill's on the House floor. Would hope that that moves forward where we'd be the 48th state, 49th state, I think, in the country to actually license dietitians. So we've been left behind on that one.
You know, Sam, this isn't legislative, but don't forget that we're less than a month away from the Republican Mackinac Conference. And I know Sarah and Jim have both been attendees to those in the past. And I'm just curious how many people are going to be there. We're used to several hundred, if not a couple thousand people there. And usually during presidential run-ups, we have multiple candidates there. I remember when we had Carly Fiorina come off the boat a couple of years ago, or Senator Thompson come off the plane, and they were mobbed. And, you know, it's just, I'm going to be curious to see how many people are on Mackinac Island for that conference and what that looks like and who shows up with a big U.S. Senate, big push that weekend. I'm really curious for that.
I'm really curious if it even happens.
Yeah. I mean, that's possible too. The thing could get canceled. Who knows?
Well, I was going to ask Jim, Sarah, are you all going? Have you all booked a hotel room?
I haven't been to that in decades. It's the hardcore. It's not for me.
I have been going very regularly throughout my time in politics, and it's generally been something I look forward to. But I'm not going to be able to make it this year, as there is a home football game versus Rutgers that I can go to the Saturday of the convention. But, you know, looking at the agenda, it doesn't, for me, speak to the same kind of prominence for those political leaders from across the country. You're not seeing them sign up in droves, you know, for one reason or another. They're not seeing this as that podium and platform that they want to use this year. And maybe relative to the consternation going on with party here, we'll see what happens. But, you know, Jim, as Jim's is asserting, we'll see if it even happens. It's still a question mark in my mind. I hear all sorts of rumors about it, but right now it looks like it's still on.
You know, I'm excited about the fall, you know, like goodbye summer. You were fun, but I'm excited for the pumpkin patch, the Capitol pumpkin patch.
Right. Well, bring back those rallies, you know, bring back lots of fun stuff here in downtown Lansing. And yeah, I'm excited. I think we're going to be super busy. But I think also if the legislature does do sine die early, there'll be a big sigh of relief by those of us who work in and out of the Capitol every day. So maybe we'll get a little bit of a break.
Well, Jim and Sarah, thank you all so much for joining us on today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here anytime.
Today, we are joined by Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, who has spent this summer negotiating with lawmakers on legislation to create the Michigan Voting Rights Act. Secretary Benson, your office informed me that this proposal aims to mirror and expand the original Federal Voting Rights Act. It consists of measures to further prohibit misinformation from being placed on voters, to clarify safeguards for voters with disabilities, and to expand the number of jurisdictions where election-related information must be translated to non-English languages. Additionally, although we're pre-recording this segment, this episode is airing on the 60-year anniversary of the Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech that he gave during the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in Washington, D.C. Secretary Benson, can you explain why you believe promoting this legislation today in Michigan, the possible establishment of a debut Michigan Voting Rights Act, how does it correlate with the sacredness of today, where individuals reflect on the I Have a Dream message?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, and especially on a historic moment like this with the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington. We actually introduced Senator Darren Camilleri and the state senators in support of it, introduced the Michigan Voting Rights Act on June 23rd, which was just around the same time of the 60th anniversary of the preceding walk in the that happened in Detroit, King's Walk to Freedom in Detroit, that was June of that year. In both instances, we recognize the work that has been done since that I Have a Dream moment in our country, and yet still the work that we have yet to do to realize that dream. And in many ways, the Michigan Voting Rights Act is recognizing not just that, but the historic experiences we've had in our democracy in Michigan and nationwide just over these last few years. The Shelby County versus Holder decision 10 years ago severely weakened the Federal Voting Rights Act, and in many legal scholars' view, really paved the way for a lot more challenges to administering the vote in a fair and equitable way in the years since. And so what the Michigan Voting Rights Act seeks to do is not just mirror and expand the original Voting Rights Act, but to really let voters know on both sides of the aisle and all around Michigan that in this moment where the challenges to democracy are clear and present in front of us, we want to give citizens the faith and the confidence that they can safely vote and participate in our democracy. The law will prohibit voter denial, dilution, and suppression. It will provide a cause of action for and against voter intimidation and deceptive practices, whether it's from the government or private actors. It will be illegal to intentionally mislead and misinform voters before, during, or after an election about election procedures. And we've seen attempts in nearly every election cycle to do just that. And yet, up to this point, very little we can do about it. And this helps us protect voters from that intentional spread of falsehoods about their voting rights. And as you mentioned, it does also expand the number of jurisdictions that have to translate election-related information into languages other than English. This is something that we've seen remarkably successful in the local jurisdictions like in Wayne County and Dearborn and Hamtramck that have already implemented translated election ballots for citizens who speak English as a second language. It helps also ensure the accuracy of the elections and reduce voter error. And then finally, we seek to, with this law, enhance and clarify protections for voters with disabilities or others who need assistance to participate in elections.
So when you talk about the disabilities, so what are kind of some of the additional supports that someone would see under this legislation?
In particular, for voters who need additional access to ensure that all of the, from election day voting to early voting to polling place accessibility, various requirements and causes of action will be in place to ensure that physical accessibility, both of the ballot and the polling places themselves. One of the things that's not lost on us and something that we've been working through with our clerks over the last several years, for example, is making sure every physical polling place location is accessible to voters. And there have been times and there have been studies that have shown many are not. And so this law seeks to rectify that and really, again, give clerks support and guardrails and clarity on how to ensure every polling place within their jurisdiction is physically accessible to voters, perhaps with limited physical abilities.
So could this include something like a drive up, a drive through polling style for someone who, let's say you're sick on the day that you wanted to vote?
It's not necessarily. I mean, I'd say, the way and we have curbside voting for citizens who are physically unable to get to the polls because the polling place is physically inaccessible. But beyond that, I think that the discussions are ongoing as to the scope of what provisions like that would actually entail and the support that clerks would receive if and when they do have to provide someone with physical disabilities who's covered under the American Disabilities Act with appropriate access to the polling place.
Madam Secretary, I've been talking with local clerks who are very concerned about the implementation of the Proposal 2 legislation, the implementation legislation that was passed without immediate effect. because Republicans in the Senate did not give immediate effect to this implementation language. And so they're concerned as we're approaching the primary election, regardless of what the date is on that, that that things such as the 9 days of early voting, the drop box requirements, the early ballots, that if they're not actually effective per law, that they're going to be running into problems. Do you believe that this has to be rectified with an early legislative signee die so that these bill or these laws can take effect by the time we have a primary election?
I think we've been trying to recognize the some of the confusion that arises when some bills, and some have gotten been given immediate effect and some have not. You've also got constitutional requirements that are in effect in February or whenever the presidential primary ultimately is. And the only real piece that we've identified that doesn't have immediate effect in February or March, but will in August and in the fall, is the issue of pre-processing those absentee ballots. And that's been our focus in making sure that we develop a plan if indeed the legislature does not adjourn at a time that enables those provisions to be in effect for the presidential primary. We have a plan on both ends. But that said, from early voting to a number of other bigger issues, they will be in effect in February and or March, or in the presidential primary, I should say. And while we as election administrators in this case and in many others often have to deal with the uncertainties that emerge in the political legislative environment, this is one in which we're actively working to ensure whichever direction the legislature ultimately goes in will be ready. But I would minimize the changes and say that many of them will have to be in effect regardless, like 9 days of early voting. And we're preparing for that. The biggest, again, thing that we know won't have immediate effect that we need to prepare for on either side is the issue of pre-processing those absentee ballots. And clerks have been pre-processing absentee ballots on election day and in a, high turnout election, very high pressure election. So we're not anticipating huge challenges there, but we understand no matter what, the presidential primary is going to be the first election where there will be significant changes, including early voting, to the way our elections operate. And our job for the next 6 months or every month leading up to that date is to make sure we are adjusting and adapting as we go along, depending on what the legislature does, but also using the funding they've already allocated to be prepared for either piece to move forward. And we will get clarity. Once the fall hits, we'll get clarity over the next few months over both that date of the election, which frankly is my biggest concern. We do need clarity about the date for voters and for our clerks. But at the same time, we'll be ready either way. And that's essentially what we do. And and it's our job to make sure we're ready, regardless of how the political process plays out.
Because if the legislature doesn't adjourn signee die early, and the law that created the February 27 date is not in effect by February 27, the primary would be, the presidential primary in Michigan would be March 11. Is that your understanding?
Yep. And so that's why I said that biggest clarity we need is that date, as opposed to clarity around the procedures. But the reason we need that clarity is not just from a preparation standpoint, but to educate voters about and to prepare our vendors and do all of the other pre-election work that we do with the clarity of that date in mind. So that clarity of date is the biggest piece. But in terms of proposal two itself, we are ready to implement proposal two in the presidential primary, and we'll track what has immediate effect and what does not in terms of the procedural elements that we are able to do.
Because the constitutional amendment still passed regardless of when the implementation language. So it's in the books. We got to do it. So
the details
into how it's going to be implemented is what you all can take care of administratively.
Correct. And, the legislature has already spoken on how they want proposal two to be implemented. And so in many ways, that gives us what we need to prepare. Either way, again, the pre-processing is the biggest piece. But in terms of the broad strokes, early voting, and prepaid postage, all of those pieces, we're already going and we're already planning. And again, the biggest unknown is the date of the election, but whether it is in February or in March, voters will have a good election experience and our clerks will be ready.
You know, what are you expecting in terms of turnout for this presidential primary in Michigan?
It's far too soon to say. We don't even know, you know, who's going to be on the ballot at this point, right? It's far too soon to know that. What we do know is that in March of 2020, we did see a significant amount of enthusiasm and turnout. And so it certainly suggests that voters are engaged. And we'll be prepared for a high turnout election. And we certainly know with early voting and the other voting options in place, from absentee voting to the in-person voting and to election day voter registration, we are seeing, regardless of the election, more people voting than in the past. People are engaged. People are energized. So I'm hopeful, and I anticipate it will be an election in which we're at the higher end of what a presidential primary turnout would be because of these new election laws and procedures that the data has all shown. When they're implemented, more people vote. But that said, it's, you know, in terms of how the politics plays out, it's too early to say, but we certainly hope to see that we continue our trend of seeing the highest turnout elections in Michigan's history in this era.
I have a follow-up question on that, because I've always thought it was interesting how the Secretary of State gets to, actually, you're charged with picking who gets to be on this presidential primary ballot. Explain when you have to do that and what's kind of the criteria you use to determine who gets to be on the ballot.
Yeah, it's the Bureau of Elections primarily, and it is kind of a it's a process in which, and I should caveat that to say we're also tracking as to whether or not state parties, which oftentimes are the main determinant of who is on and off the ballot, who's considered a presidential candidate or not, is, you know, that piece is evolving as well. Will the Republican state party have a caucus? Will they go with the primary? You know, all of that is evolving, I think, is an unfolding. In addition to this question of who will still be in or be in the race in February or March. So a lot of it is very much based on what the parties want and consider to be candidates for their nominating process, which ultimately that's what this is. And there's a flexibility to it that doesn't exist in the traditional ballot access questions, where voters are seeing candidates who have met either signature collection requirements, or although some parties do implement those, paying a fee to get on the ballot or a nomination convention. So it's a bit different. And certainly in a moment like this, there's going to be a lot of discussion, I think, that we'll see unfold in the months ahead about ballot access for the presidential candidates.
You know, this doesn't have to be a Michigan-specific question, but thinking about states overall, I mean, could a state election official say, you know, because of Donald Trump and his indictments, we're not going to let him on our ballot?
As you know, that's something that a lot of legal scholars are weighing in on right now. I think the bottom line for me is we're going to follow the law. We're going to follow the Constitution. We're going to see how these constitutional and legal questions, which are not cut and dry, play out in the months ahead, not just in the primary process, but with ongoing legal questions as well, evolving. So I would just say to everyone, like, you know, it's going to be a quite a historic election cycle one way or the other. And I think we already see that unfolding with the candidates at play and the debates and the investigations and all the rest and the criminal indictments. Our job in Michigan as election administrators will be just to make sure that the process goes smoothly and that we operate by the book, according to law, in a way that in issues of, as you just, the example you just suggested, are really novel. We've never really had to grapple with something like that before. How are we doing so that complies with the law and the Constitution, but also is mindful of the precedent that's created, particularly in this era of false equivalency where, you know, you have facts and then you have aspersions and conspiracy theories. And how do we make sure the law is applied in a way that's rooted in facts and evidence always and aligns with what legal precedent would suggest? So all of those factors. And then there's a question of who should it be: the court? Should it be ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court who makes decisions like that or weighs in on that in addition to state officials? So I think we should expect to see all of that unfold in the months ahead. And I have said for really since 2020 that this presidential cycle in 2024 is I believe, in many ways, going to be the grand finale of all of the bumps and the challenges we've seen and endured since the 2020 election cycle, maybe even since 2016. And there's a lot of variables and a lot of unknowns that have yet to play out. But from my standpoint, from my office's standpoint, from the Bureau's standpoint, the law and the Constitution will be our North Star, alongside the principles of protecting every voice and every vote for every Michigander.
So to be clear, Secretary, is it possible that Donald Trump won't make our presidential primary ballot because of these legal issues? Is that a possibility?
I would say there are valid legal arguments being made to that effect, but it's far too soon to really assess the likelihood of that, because a lot of the facts and the evidence and the legal analysis that all of that would have to be rooted in have still yet to be played out. But it's something that not just in our state, but colleagues in every state, I mean, the secretaries of state of multiple states are having conversations about just that. Democrats and Republicans, with, again, the clarity that we want to know what the law is and make a decision rooted in that, not in politics, but with a notion of what the reality is in this moment. So I'm talking with folks in Pennsylvania, with secretary states in Nevada, and even in Maine, people who are in Georgia, of course, my colleague Brad Raffensperger, just to kind of get a sense of what the facts are, what the evidence is, what the timeline is. And but knowing there has been now, and there likely will be, an ongoing legal question about the former president's eligibility to be on the ballot, rooted in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution.
Well, and I was just thinking about our own Constitution. I know we've got a constitutional amendment that if you have been convicted of a crime violating the public trust, you can't even serve in public office for 20 years.
Yeah, and the conviction piece is the line. That is as many who have, there's a 100 page law review from Federalist Society experts that I've read on this subject, as well as various other legal analyses that have been in The Atlantic by Judge Luttig and Larry Tribe, or Professor Tribe, and many others. So like, there's a lot of reading and research that I think is ongoing and will need to be done, as well as legal analyses. But in addition to that, I would say the conviction piece is how, under our laws, you know, that removal has been predicated, right? Because it's very clear, if a jury of your peers finds that you have violated the law, then that triggers this. That there's other legal arguments that says a conviction is not necessary to trigger the 14th Amendment in this case, in the case of the former president's eligibility. And that's part of what is an ongoing sort of legal question. What is the due process requirement then? What is the, how do we define insurrection? Who defines that? I think the biggest thing to keep in mind is it's not as cut and dried as some legal scholars would suggest. But my approach and the approach I am talking with all of my colleagues about, or I should say many of my colleagues about in other states on both sides of the aisle, is what's the law? What's our duty under the Constitution? And how do we proceed in a way that abides by that and doesn't, you know, and is mindful of any precedental implications of decisions that are made, not just in Michigan, but in other states. So it's, you know, stay tuned. But again, this is one example of why I believe the next 18 months are going to be a bumpy ride for election administration. But it has been a bumpy ride since 2020, and it just keeps on being bumpy. So we, and with every bump that we overcome, we get better and wiser and stronger and more connected as a community and more ready to take on the next challenge. So, and the other thing I'll just emphasize is our North Star, in addition to the law and the Constitution, is voter confidence in elections and making sure that voters have as much autonomy, authority, and confidence in not just their access to the vote, but the accuracy of the results once tallied.
You know, in the final moments of our conversation, I would like to ask about your past. You resided in Montgomery, Alabama, working for the Southern Poverty Law Center to research white supremacists and neo-Nazi organizations. Can you just tell us a little bit about that experience, and how did you even get into that type of work in the first place?
Yeah, I started my career in Montgomery, Alabama, investigating hate groups and hate crimes throughout the country. And it was really rooted in a desire, similar to how we began our conversation today, in understanding the law, understanding the fight to just ensure everyone has a voice. My parents were special education teachers. And so, you know, really rooted in my life with them, saw growing up how important it is for everyone to have a voice and for everyone to be treated fairly, for everyone to have a shot to make it in education, the workplace. And my sort of understanding of the injustices that have particularly were addressed or confronted in the South in the 1960s led me to want to live in Montgomery and work for a civil rights organization and really understand the connection between the work of the past and the work of today. And so that's why I went there, and it was life-changing. I went undercover at the age of 19 with white supremacist organizations and like gathered information about them, their activities, their membership, and ultimately the why. You know, why, what made someone veer into violence through extremism ideology? It's one thing to sort of adopt an extremist ideology. It's another thing to commit crimes or commit violent acts as a result of it. And, you know, where's that connection and what? And so just doing that work was really transformative and ironically prepared me in many ways for this moment that we're now in. And certainly being in Selma, Alabama was pivotal for me in wanting to, with my career, continue the work of those who stood on the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965 and took the beatings, the billy clubs and the tear gas so that we could have a Voting Rights Act for all. And I've really tried to fashion my career around making sure that voting is accessible to everyone in that regard and that government works for all.
As someone who studied and had such a direct view of widely recognized extremism groups, do you ever feel like the word extremism is used too much in our current political ecosystem?
It's certainly, I think you can make that argument, certainly. It's something that I don't use as much as other people do for that reason, because it, I think, can be overused and certainly subjectively interpreted or used in some ways to dismiss what could be otherwise valid positions. And so it is a word that I think is sometimes misused or used in a way that is not productive and shuts down conversation as opposed to allows for collaboration. So, but there are also times when it is appropriate. And certainly when you're talking about the spectrum of an ideology and a very far, far right in this example of white supremacy and the neo-Nazi ideology that I was tracking. There is also a time and place to use, I think, a word that does apply to what is a viewpoint that is not held by the vast majority, I believe, of Americans, and that does lead to really extreme actions, which is the violence and crimes I was mentioning.
So in the last 3 years, and this will be my final question, the last 3 years looking at national headlines, what was one situation where the word extremism you feel was misused? And what was one situation do you think it was fun?
I certainly think when talking about the violence that and the tragedy that we witnessed in our Capitol in the U.S. Capitol on January 6th was an extreme example of essentially, you know, going far too far to disrupt or try to overturn a presidential election. But there have been times where, you know, there have been more moderate approaches that on both sides. And certainly we see this with regards to people in the Democratic Party being, I should say, in an era of false equivalency, we see the word extremism used to create a sense of false equivalency when it's really not equivalent. And that's where, to me, I come back to being rooted in just facts and evidence and precedent and the law and history and where the majority of American people actually are on a lot of issues, which is the opposite of extreme. It's sort of the majority, the moderate center. And the more we can be rooted there, the more we can, I think, more accurately define extremism on other sides. But we've seen it used, I think, misused politically on both sides to capture what in many ways is perhaps a position grounded in facts and evidence and sound legal history, even if it's something that someone doesn't agree with. We see that oftentimes countered as extreme, even if it's not. But then you see the images coming out of our U.S. Capitol from January 6, 2021. And certainly that defines to me an extreme step reaction rooted in lies and misinformation that oftentimes also defines extremism on both sides of the aisle.
Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, thank you so much for joining us today on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks for having me. I loved our discussion and happy to come back anytime.
Well, either way, I'm kind of excited for the fall. I think this is going to be a good fall. I already had my pumpkin spice flavored drink and I'm excited to get back to Lansing.
I heard the pumpkin spice latte is back, so.
Well, and that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our morning roundtable participants, Senior Government Relations Professional Jim Murray of Tradecraft Strategies, the past Deputy Chief of Staff to previous Michigan House Speaker Rick Johnson, and Legislative Strategist Sarah Hubbard of Acuitas LLC. Additionally, thank you to Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson. I also want to give a tremendous thanks to MERS editor Kyle Malin. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next week, I am Samantha Shriver. Mother Nature, she's always right, so why do we must fight to get